Kit Hogg, Penny Hogg, Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they?
At home with the Hoggs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Buenos dias and welcome to the next 2 hours of stories, satire, music and conversation. That is your magazine programme on Talk Radio Europe, the show that puts expatriates in the driving seat. I'm Kit Hogg.
And I'm Penny Hogg. Good morning.
And it's great to have the pleasure of your company as the weekend unfolds into... Well, who knows what? We have ideas and plans for how things might go, but actually, it's all in the hands of the great unknown. Fate.
As ever, fate. Anything could happen.
That's right. It's down to the universe, really.
Amazing we even got here, really.
Less of a mystery is what we have in store for you here today, although even that is far from predictable, not unlike my wife.
I was just a bit shocked just on the way here just now. I'm in my little car.
By the way, we came to the studio separately.
So it's been a
the
big
heifer
change.
The sort of she's planted a flag staking independence. She wants to drive separately to the studio.
I'll appeal off.
There's some sort of weird agenda going on after the show.
This little car stopped on the roundabout, and I hope they're listening, on the roundabout. And it didn't even pull in, and the back door opened, and a little boy opened the back door. He was obviously being told to go and have a pee or be sick or whatever on the roundabout. I nearly killed him. So I'm slightly nervy this morning.
Beating the desk with indignation.
Yes, I am. No, but just how silly can you be? Anyway, all was well. In my new car. We're going to talk about buying a new car, aren't we?
We are, yeah. Really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Love talking about cars.
Too. Yep.
Check it out, girls.
And I'm going to be talking about the pen clam, Carnival, or mysterious things that you find in supermarkets, which I wonder if anybody ever buys.
Did you say pen clam?
The pen clam, yes.
That's named after you.
I hadn't thought of that, actually. Yes, it was clam. Not sure. The pen shell clam.
Okay. A little while later, we go to America, where did you know that just this week, Chicago has been colder than Antarctica? Andy Wood's letter from New Jersey with the end of the shutdown, the phenomenon that is the Super Bowl, and abnormally large icicles at 12:40 today.
The Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl. It's a sporting event, Malibu. We wouldn't worry.
So we've got
your pretty little head over that.
Yeah, one car... feature and sporting event.
Yeah, it's turning into a boys' show. JJ the pool doctor. He's in Belgium where it's also freezing. Actually, we're unlikely to get hold of JJ, so rest easy on that. Matthew Bennett's Spain Report joined us. Matthew Bennett, he joins us in about 40 minutes to talk about the new right in Spain, namely the party called Vox. You may have heard of them. Are they a manifestation of Europopulism or something darker? And just after 12, we're delighted to welcome Andaluz resident Steph Lipka, who, following his recent return from the old country, takes an askance look at Blighty before joining us on Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens to talk to us about the day his finca was consumed by fire. Yes, it's all simmering.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
And I just wanted to start with a revelation of the bleeding obvious. I have to share this with you. I've just listened to it on the news. And maybe you heard this astonishing item on the UK national news today, that a recently published study suggests that the presence of mobile phones in the classroom could be detrimental to learning.
No.
Astonishing, isn't it?
They're not going to ban... What, kids are allowed to take phones into class?
Apparently, it's an inalienable right for kids to take phones into class.
Why?
I don't know. It's part of their ability to...
to be free.
To be human beings. And I mean, this is a controversial report that deigns to suggest that the presence of a mobile phone in the classroom might be detrimental to the absorption of knowledge. In counter to that, fears have been expressed that banning them might actually force mobile phones in the classroom underground. So there we are. That's a little bit of an askance look at Blighty.
It certainly is.
Paige, what have you got for us?
Well, right now, should we talk about the weird things in supermarkets?
Well, whatever you like, my darling.
Okay. Now then, have you ever seen a jar of palmitos?
A jar of palmitos?
A jar of palmitos. In fact, I bought one a jar last night, and I don't think you've noticed them.
No, I thought palmitos were... like a confectionery that you get from a bakery that are sort of weird palm-shaped leaf thing covered in chocolate, not very convincing chocolate.
No, they're actually palm hearts.
Oh.
And okay. I thought...
Oh, really? Really from palms?
From real-life palm trees, yes. And I partly bought them because when we talked at Arbolista and we talked trees, we talked about palms quite a lot, but also how the heart of a palm, if you take out the heart of a palm, you kill it, don't you?
Of course, that's what the bicho does.
Yes, but in fact, palmitos are actually grown nowadays in Costa Rica, and the ones in the supermarket, which I went to yesterday, which I can say because it's not the BBC, is Mercadona. And they
Mercadona!
You haven't quite got the intonation right, but I'm not going to sing it, and they come from the peach palm.
Right, okay.
It's called the peach palm.
And that would be the cojoya, wouldn't it? The little nutty centre.
Well, apparently they send out shoots from the main stem, and it's those shoots that become the palm hearts.
Okay.
And apparently they're very, very good for you. So keep your eye out for them. You just wouldn't think, oh, I'll have some of those. They're in the same section as the bottled tomatoes and the bottled peas and stuff like that. Yes, have a look out for them.
We actually felled a palm the other day, and the gitanos started setting about it with a knife and cut out the middle.
Did they cut
out the white fleshy center at the base of the copa, the base of the canopy, which we call the cojoyo. And began eating it, chopping it into chunks, and began eating it. And it is very delicious. It's nutty, it's succulent, it's white. And
very good for you.
Apparently.
Lots of sodium, lots of phosphorus, lots of vitamin C.
Is that? Yep.
You can obviously look it up if you feel so inclined. But palmitos, yes, bred and produced in Costa Rica and shipped over to here. And you can get them in all sorts of sugary sap or just get them al natural.
Mm.
And there's a picture of a little toucan on them.
Okay.
So another strange thing that I actually wonder what it is sometimes, stacked in or next door to the honey is miel de caña, which is not miel.
Miel de caña is sugar cane.
Yeah, sugar cane syrup.
Which
I suppose, I mean, I don't know what treacle is, but would treacle be sugar cane syrup? No.
I'm never sure, no. Yeah. It's molasses.
So treacle was always such a exotic thing, wasn't it? Did your mum used to make flapjacks?
She pretended it was exotic because we couldn't afford honey in days of pre-rationing or post-rationing. So we had Tate & Lyle's golden syrup in the green can with the lion on it that was sort of laid down with flies buzzing about it.
I loved that.
We had that with stewed apple.
Yeah.
And the stewed apple had toenails in it. I mean, bits of apple that she'd been too lazy to...
No, not too lazy, Daniel. She just wanted the roughage. But, yes, so why would the picture of the lion with his flies buzzing around it be...
Well, he's just obviously eaten a can of Tate & Lyle's golden syrup and is so overcome with the experience. He's so relaxing. And he's still... I don't think they're flies, they're bees. He's still got honey around his muzzle, treacle around his muzzle, which has attracted the bees.
Okay, which you can make flapjacks out of, obviously. Another mysterious thing, which I actually looked at the other, again yesterday, is cabello de ángel.
Now, are there two L's in that?
Yes, cab, E, double L, O.
Oh, it would be cabello.
I'm sorry, Cabello,
yeah, which is angel's hair, isn't it?
Well, it could be, I suppose, but it's also called, it's pulpo or pulpo de calabaza, which is
a pumpkin.
A pumpkin, shredded pumpkin,
yeah,
with sugar.
Yeah.
And so you buy that in a can. And again, I've got confused there. I thought it was courgette, but of course it's pumpkin, isn't it? So that would be...
Yeah, the sort of fibrousy bits.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So, and that's actually worth a try. Should we try that one day? It's in these cans.
I have done it. It's in manifestly disappointing. And it'll be way, way too sweet for you.
Yeah, you've tried it, have you?
Mm.
Okay. Mm. Right. So that is my very, very weird things to eat, which we... Yeah, I think we'll try the palms.
Yeah, the palms sound the most promising out of that lot. You know, we were talking about eating out in Spain last week and casting not unfounded aspersions on complacency and indifference in some of the vendors and restaurants we've eaten at lately, which has unsurprisingly coincided with my taking a picnic to work, you know, sandwiches, the odd pork pie from Melton Mowbray via the overseas supermarket.
Sandwiches.
Can't be making sandwiches every morning.
And then bringing back the ones from the day which you haven't eaten and then warming them up on the wood burner.
That's right, yes, in silver foil. And, of course, the ubiquitous can of tuna. And it was while opening a ring pull can of tuna last week, a stubborn one, that I came within a whisker of severing a tendon at the base of my thumb on the razor-sharp, partially opened lid. Picture this most unedifying scene. I'm sitting in my car, bleeding into an open baguette that was supposed to be the recipient of the tuna, groping with my other hand, my still good hand, for a packet of plasters that were fortuitously located in the central console, a section of which I then had to cut using a hunting knife. I had no scissors. And then try and stick over the wound to stem the flow of blood before resuming my breakfast. Thinking...
Lovely.
I'm thinking picnics aren't supposed to be like this, really.
No. I think you make the sandwich before you get in the car normally. That's what somebody would. And the hunting knife and the plasters.
That's right. Yeah.
I think it's like disorientation.
Yeah, if your wife hasn't done it for you. Yeah.
No, she wouldn't do it.
Another picnic ingredient that I sampled the other day was a tub of glutinous, oversweet satay sauce from a Dutch supermarket. Now, living on the Costa del Sol is interesting. And if you're on the Costa Blanca, presumably you have niche supermarkets as well, like Finnish supermarkets. Scandi supermarkets.
Yes. I don't know where you find these places.
Well, you're just driving along and you see Dutch supermarket.
Okay.
And that's where I stopped the other day. And you go in and, well, it's kind of like a little window on what it's like to be a Dutch person. I mean, there's just a technical avenues of packets. It's package heaven, and everything's in packets. So imagine buying toast packets.
Buying toast, like Melba toast.
Yeah, round toast. They're mad on round toast, but packets of round toast. And lots of variations of round toast. You think you get, right, a packet of round toast. That's a packet of round toast. But there are about 8 variations of round toasts. And then what you do with the round toast, and if you are Dutch and you're listening, you might want to correct me on this, but as I understand it, you buy a packet of small chocolate-coloured shapes in white, dark or milk chocolate, and you sprinkle them on top of the round toasts, like a sort of hundreds and thousands. What else? There are tinned wursts.
Wursts?
Called rundenaks. Those are sausages.
Sausages.
Yes, sausages in cans.
This sounds like to me eat. Like a Brexit emergency food. You see, you could get a whole load of this. We'd take it home in case.
If you can't import it from. No, I mean, we don't have a problem
with
Brexit.
We don't have to worry because we're here.
Okay, no, exactly. Yeah. And we can always go to the supermarket, which happens to be in San Pedro. pancake mix, loads of packets of pancake mix. Edam in about a dozen varieties. You would have thought that. Edam just came in one variety, but there's old Amsterdam, old Rotterdam, old whatever, or just loads of varieties. A bakery section featuring wursts in pastry.
Right.
And then there's a whole sort of ethnic thing, which is quite interesting, that reflects the Dutch East India Company and their sort of tentacles of empire. So sambal paste from the Indonesia? From Indonesia, and the woman was telling me, this nice Dutch lady who was there, she was telling me that if I want something even hotter, I would go to the Suriname section.
And right, hang on, sambal paste, what is that?
Sambal paste is a chili paste, a red chili paste that literally blows your head off. I've had some before. But this,
have you tried this particular one?
The sambal I have.
Yeah.
And this lady told me that if I'm a real man, if I really want to put hairs on my chest, I go for the Suriname section.
Well, drop hairs off your chest by the sound of it. Yeah,
the Suriname section. Suriname is you found out where Suriname is, didn't
yes,
you, Ben?
Yes, I've forgotten that.
It's a small country in South America, which used to be Dutch Guiana.
Which is where that amazing book, Papillon, was set.
Yes, they're those sort of swamp countries, yeah. Mm. But so swamp and kind of crocodiles and tropical diseases. But if you want to take your mind off that stuff,
right,
then get into some seriously hot food.
Hot food in steamy countries.
Still on food, pea milk, anyone? It's probably better than it sounds. It's
PEA milk, as in legume.
That's right, yeah. Right, we've talked checking. About underwhelming plant milks, but pea milk is the latest to hit the market. And
it's truly vegan, presumably.
It apparently oat milk and nut milks are yesterday now. Bring on the latest non-dairy milk in the form of a pea. Mm-hmm. It's not green, and it doesn't taste like mushed petit pois. It's not like mushy peas. Rather, pea milk is a nut-free, soya-free, lactose-free, gluten-free. You might wonder what it is, actually. It's not got anything to do with cow. And it's set to join the ranks of coconut and almond in a growing market. It's made by grounding yellow split peas into a flour and then separating the pea protein from the fiber and starch. Water, oils, and vitamins are then blended with the pea protein to provide, it says here, a palatable drink that contains more calcium than some plant-based products and up to 8 times the protein of almond milk.
Hang on a minute. So you said that stuff is added to it. What do they say it was added?
It's made by grinding yellow split peas into a flour and then separating the pea protein from the fibre and the starch.
And then adding something
water,
else.
Oils and vitamins, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, most of these milks have water. If you look at the ingredients,
yeah,
you see water has been
vitamins, there. If you're putting that in, that sounds a bit cheaty to me.
Okay, well, we'll see. I don't think it's available here in Spain as yet. It's being marketed in Blighty under the Mighty Society Pea Milk label. So look out for that one. No doubt it will appear in your health food stores. We've got a bid on health food stores coming up later. Now, you remember last week how we told you how we waved our sad flooded vehicles goodbye and how watching them wend their way north to a scrapyard in the Asturias, it occurred to us to replace them.
Yep.
So you've got $5,000... You might want to play this at home, actually. It's good game. It's good fun. You've got $5,000 to spend on an SUV.
Well, didn't have
Do you know what SUV stands for, babe?
Yes. Please don't get too rude this morning. Yes, I do.
Well, okay, are you able to share it with us?
Sports utility vehicle.
Fantastic. My God, I never knew that.
Mainly
for road use, an SUV has a four-wheel drive capability, sometimes known as a soft roader. And it's de rigueur for yummy mummies doing the school runs at Soto Grande, Calpe, Aloha or Torrevieja. And indeed for the more seasoned but equally yummy mummy, that is the heifer, who drives a four-kilometre dirt track to and fro La Casa to the outside world several times a day. Now, purchasing a vehicle in the transient world of the Spanish Costas, there are bargains to be had, but there are also pitfalls. And with a $5,000 budget, you can make savings on book price by buying a car from an expat leaving in a hurry. A car with dodgy paperwork or no paperwork at all, or a car not matriculated here in Spain. But if you want a quiet life with no comebacks or the rest of your days hobbled at the ankles by red tape, your main decision would appear to be diesel or petrol.
Or colour.
Yeah, yeah, colour's important, isn't it?
Yes, well, that's what I thought of.
Apparently, grey is the most... is the most popular colour.
The most anonymous colour.
And at the moment, no, it's the most popular. It used to be silver, but grey is the most popular. But well, let's go back to diesel or petrol, because gasolina, una ruina, is the popular refrain of the campesino. And indeed, it's rare to find anything other than diesel in the campo, from ancient coughing Santana Land Rovers, Mitsubishi Galloper seven-seaters blowing out black smoke, through to the now ubiquitous Ford Ranger pickup. In the campo, everyone drives diesel. And diesel, that was actually the first car you tried, wasn't it, my love? Can you remember the first car you tried?
Yes, I do. I do. And we've already discussed the exciting drive.
And what was it?
Please. I don't know. This movie.
Can you not share it with us?
Nobody's interested in that, surely.
Okay. It was, in fact, a 15-year-old Land Rover Discovery.
Oh, yes.
Wasn't it? Do you remember it? You didn't get on very well with it.
No, I didn't. That's just why I don't particularly... I think we should do a whole programme one day on what people remember.
Depends what they want to remember. The Land Rover Discovery, though, it wasn't really your thing, was it? It was swaying about. It had the sort of ergonomics of an elephant on a bicycle. So that was a no-no.
And terrified the person who owned it, I think.
And then our mechanic, Chris, called with a thing called a Kia Sorento. A what? I said. Kia Sorento. Just what you're looking for. He said, 4x4, turbo diesel, ETUV, and a good price. Owning something like a Korean car, I realised, was not unlike contemplating leaving Spain to live somewhere like Whitney in Oxfordshire. It was kind of a bit like shoehorning your weeping soul into a small airless box.
Easy, comfortable and warm. It occurred
to me forcibly that in this short life, there are compromises that one really ought not to make, compromises that undermine one's self-respect, like driving a Citroen Berlingo or being seen in a Kia Sorento. And for this reason, I asked Chris if the Sorento had tinted glass so that I might travel incognito and avoid any unnecessary erosion of fan base. But the heifer's not as sad as I am and actually test drove the Sorento. Now, how did you get on with the Sorento?
It was fine. I can't remember that one. Yeah, no.
You said you didn't like it.
No, didn't like it. That's all you need to know.
Okay, yeah. So it was no to the Sorento, and it was no to a cheap diesel Range Rover that also appeared. And then in the portals of Facebook, you saw a nice blue car for sale, didn't you?
That was the one.
There was a Nissan Murano. Do we know what Murano means?
No idea.
Okay, I don't either. And it was advertised by someone called Patrice from France, obviously, whom I envisaged as a pliant mademoiselle with a penchant for mature male company, and in anticipation of our meeting began reawakening my French with break-the-ice phrases like, "Bonjour, mademoiselle, c'est jolie la voiture."
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Disconcertingly.
I've just looked up Murano. It's an island in Venice, Italy.
Oh, right, okay. That's quite exotic, maybe, and thoroughly suitable. But anyway, going back to Patrice, he turned out to be a bloke, which was slightly disconcerting. And the car was gasoline. But in fact, this wasn't disconcerting, because Patrice was a nice guy, and the car, the Nissan Murano, named after an island in Venice, was at least $2,000 cheaper than had it been diesel. And under the hood was an animal of an engine. So that was nice. So this is a question you have to ask yourself. While I bask in power and luxury, how many kilometres do I have to do to make up the price difference? And how long would it take me to do them? 2 or 3 years? And will I have the car that long anyway? I mean, will I last that long anyway?
Got another 2 years.
So, well, you'd be lucky. So we bought the Nissan Murano. And it's been fine, hasn't it? Apart from the electric windows.
Yeah, and the paperwork. When you said earlier about buying from an expat and all of that, he's actually disappeared to the Philippines. I can't get hold of him.
The Transferencia.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Well. But as for electric windows, whoever invented them has a lot to answer for, because they're great as long as they work. And after that, they're just emasculating. I mean, several Julys ago, a friend called Sophie, driving the kids back from Sevilla, hermetically sealed in a Mercedes saloon, windows jammed shut with no aircon. I mean, I don't know why, like electric gates, they can't make an override on electric windows so that you can click a mechanical switch and you can operate them manually.
I've been wondering that a lot.
Anyway, babe, let's not talk about cars anymore, because I could tell she keeps looking out of the window.
Glazing over with car talk. That's it for now.
Let's calm down with a nice poem.
Now, this is actually a rather sad poem, but it's written by Claire Booker, and it's called Gibral Faro, View from the Gibral Faro, Malaga. Here, where caliphs wove empires, only the calling of swifts at breakfast above burnt ochre crenellations that steamed like washed horses. From this height, the city's noise pools at its ankles. There are tower blocks, cranes, cement silos, a cruise liner in its rectangular bath. A tiny bicycle cuts a stubborn line across the Avenida de Toros. In the old town, La Manquita exposes her back, red, shrunken, almost shameful. Hills and churches spread north like a painted Belen. Even the tips of the Sierras seem touchable. I can see almost everything except you. Today, you'll lay your head on the well-turned soil of a Surrey morning. The quiet truth of you, breathed out in snowdrop and celandine.
TRE.radio. At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
And welcome back. We've got John Dodge on the line. John, hi.
Oh, yes, without the S. Yes, I was fascinated with your business about the Nissan, and I've gone back to cars because I'm living with them all the time, as against aeroplanes, although I have that as well, but that's another story. But that flatbed Fords, that was the thing I wanted to pick you up on. A month or two months ago.
It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. Yeah, that's what it was about, wasn't it? That immortal Eagles song, Take It Easy. Yeah, go on, John.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I'm always into your program because you and your dear lady speak so nicely and teach us the way to speak English. And you're very, very conversant with nearly every subject, especially trees. And I studied trees once because they said I wasn't educated enough to be any kind of engineer, and I had to study trees and be a carpenter. But
where do the cars fit into this, John?
Pardon?
Where do cars fit into this? Did you say that your life revolved around cars?
Yeah, earlier? I've got the biggest garage in the world in Turiana. Fixes them.
you do.
And I came back to a flatbed. Well, we've been working on flatbed Fords and Chevrolets for years. You know.
Oh, really? You're into American cars, yeah?
Oh yes, very much. That's where it all started.
With a name like Dodge, yes, I mourn the loss of my Dodge.
Oh yes.
Yeah, I had a Dodge. She doesn't. I had a Dodge Ram that blew up. John, it's really nice to hear from you, but we're going to have to press on.
You and your dear lady are invited to a high coffee, tea and breakfast or anything you like. When you'll be able to find me now, won't you?
I'd love to come. Yeah, seriously, though, do write to us. I would love to come and see your collection.
You love it. The one with the airplane engine in is still running. Oh. It's in the garage. The one with the 27 Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. And you can find me on Top Gear by just dialing in John Dodd Beast on YouTube. And you've got me on Top Gear in London.
Okay, is it John Dodd? D-O-D?
D-O-D. DOD, that's right, yeah.
Oh, it says you're not John Dodge at all.
No, John Dodge.
You come up as John Dodge on the studio.
I think as one of that, your other persons.
No, okay, well, we'll correct that. Lovely to hear you, mate. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
Adios, John.
Bye, John.
It's time for our morning story. It's called Cat Rescue. Talk to any fireman or bombero and ask them with what frequency they expect to rescue a cat in a tree rendered paralytic by vertigo. As an arborist here on the Costa del Sol, I can tell you that about every 9 months, your average tree surgeon would expect to conduct an aerial rescue on a cat. Cats, of course, are prodigious climbers, and trees provide them with a perfect refuge from, for example, dogs and other predators. Though I can't actually think of any other predators on cats at the moment. Anatomically, most animals, though, are better at ascending than coming back down. Though I do have to note that extraordinary squirrel we saw in the botanical gardens in Lisbon last month.
The red squirrel.
What's so cool about him? He was in mid-descent. He stopped dead still. He was about 10 metres up on a vertical palm stem facing straight down the pole at us. Spitting.
Really
slowly.
Cross.
He didn't like us at all.
But it's so incongruous to see a red squirrel in a palm tree.
Yes, but facing the wrong way. You think, how do you do that without toppling?
Or even the right way.
Cats can't do that anyway. They can go up, but they can't come down. And once in the top of a palm, cling on, yowling in a panic-stricken and unpleasant way. A noise that is unsettling for everyone in the neighbourhood. And it's at this point that the distressed cat lover is on the phone, and we're on our way. Arbalista Pussycat Rescue. Take Jasmina, for example. Not a cat, actually, though feline all the same. The bewitchingly pretty proprietor of a herborista health store. From which she tempts the Nueva Andalucía Cognoscenti with dream catchers, new age albums, glinting crystals, scented candles, Japanese teapots, sticks of soft aromatic Palo Santo, cedar incense holders, discreet displays of bespoke jewellery, massage oils, and a bewildering array of herbal teas, from Vox Clara on the Yogi label to a pale blue detox by Pucker, and a mouthwatering selection of Bounce energy bombs. The dark chocolate and raspberry one is a particular favourite of mine. And haven't her baristas changed over 20 years?
I'm just imagining you going in there and asking pretty, what's her, Jasmina?
Jasmina, yeah. I've told you about her, dear.
Yes.
You know about her.
Yes, I think particularly any, inverted commas, complaints you may have had and shared with her.
I just wanted to say, though, talking of Jasmina, how her baristas have changed in the last 20 years. I remember them.
Definitely, yeah.
Absolutely, like dreadful places, bereft of imagination, with the soul of a sort of sepiaed pharmacy. I mean, like glum, joyless, staffed by women dressed as lab assistants selling powdered herbs in packets.
Yeah, no, they've definitely come on. Yeah, I enjoy them, I have to admit.
I mean, it's a whole era apart from Jasmina's herbalista health boutique where I stock up on maca root, tribulus silvestris, rhodiola rosea, muria puauma, and ginseng. And these are supplements that purport to postpone erectile dysfunction and incontinence in men of a certain age. Jasmina advises me sweetly on such matters and coquettishly asks me to report back as to how her remedies have renewed my manhood. It's all a bit toe-curling, especially when there's a small queue of gym bunnies behind me. Jasmina complements her shop perfectly. Quite simply, she is its aura, and her attention to her clients is one of beguiling, almost hypnotic charm. But a few weeks ago, apropos of nothing, she actually called me. It was nothing to do with market research on South American roots. In fact, she was crying. Christopher, tiene que ayudarme. ¿Me puede bajar un gato de una palmera? You've got to help me. Can you get a cat down from a palm tree for me? Well, by coincidence, we were working close to where she told me she lived. But on arrival, I was shocked. You see, I'd pictured her in a landscaped version of her shop. For all these years, I'd been labouring under the illusion that somehow a garden is a reflection of you. So, at the other polarity of what I imagined to be Hasmina's garden to be, was this place in which Juanito and I were now standing. It was so odd, I had to check the gate number. But no, here was Jesus, her husband. Yes, this is Jasmina's house, a white bungalow, and she's inside it. And the garden? Jasmina's garden, far from the intimate scented paradise with willows, roses, raised beds of organic veg, jasmine, tinkling water features and wind chimery, all intimate nooks and crannies that I'd been imagining, was as surgically sterile as a corporate light well. A square of artificial lawn bordered by featureless white boundary walls. Out of the carpet of astroturf grew the only living thing in the garden, a predictable Washingtonia palm, and at the top, quite audibly though unseen from the ground, was a cat. Now, rescuing a cat from a palm is not unlike putting your hand into a roll of barbed wire. Both cat and palm are formidably armed with claws and spikes, so dress for the job in full body Kevlar armour, with a face guard, and most important, stout gloves. Oh, and make sure you take a bag, a stout bag with a drawstring that you can lower on a rope. The bag is for the cat. Because when a strange head pokes its way through the foliage of its entrapment, the cat doesn't perceive you as a benign instrument of rescue. This ugly face calling, "Kitty, kitty, good kitty, come on," is actually predatory and further reason to freak out. At which point the rescuer needs to act with decisive precision to avoid getting shredded by the surrounding barbs of palm and grab the cat with a gauntleted hand, insert it firmly into the bag you've remembered to bring with you, draw the strings and lower it to the ground on a rope. Jasmina, who had been too traumatised to make an appearance, now emerged from her house, wan and pale. With her permission, I opened the bag and we stood back. A large grey cat bolted for freedom, galloped the artificial plastic lawn and vanished over the wall. I looked questioningly at Jasmina. "It wasn't my cat," she told me. "My six cats are all inside." "And now, Christopher," she said, regaining her composure, "would you like a lawnmower? I'd like to give it to you. My new green grass doesn't need a lawnmower anymore."
Talk Radio Europe.
At home. Hello and welcome back.
With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Yes, welcome back. It's time.
Oh, what? 1, 2, 3, 4. My bed and a pillow for my head. I got a pencil full of lead and some water for my throat. I got buttons for my coat and sails on my boat. So much more than I needed before. I got money in the meter and a turbo heater. Oh, and now it's getting on the road. So they're getting sweeter. I got legs on my tails and a head for a hair. Bought a pan and some shoes.
Nothing's going to bring me down, not even Matthew Bennett this morning. He's been 20 years an intimate observer, not only of the Spanish political scene, but of things Spanish in general from the Spain Report, now on the Patreon platform, the hallmark of independent journalism in Spain. Matthew, welcome.
Morning, Kit.
And sorry, we're a little bit late. Sorry, man. So we've got to move quickly on this. And how have you been keeping? All right.
Yeah, I'm good. Well, good. Better, thank you.
Good. Better than what?
Better than having that flu for a week.
Ah, you've had the flu.
Hi, Matthew.
Oh, Matthew.
If I cough a little today, please excuse me.
Okay, that's absolutely fine. Your sound looks clear as a bell. Now listen, Matthew.
That was great music you just had on. Where was that from?
That is, we were messing with the phones here. Sorry about that. It was Paolo Nutini. It's called Nothing's Going to Bring Me Down. Paolo Nutini, he doesn't sound like a Scot, but he's actually from Glasgow.
No, he's not.
He is, yeah.
Wow, I'll look that up later.
Yeah, Paolo Nutini, he's done some other really nice stuff. Let's talk Spanish current affairs. Last week, you published a graph showing the poll ratings for the main political parties here in Spain, yeah. All of which are drooping, with one exception, notably Vox. This thing with Vox, I mean, how much, there's a fair bit of hysteria going on around Vox. And the question I want to ask you is this, is Vox just a part of this phenomenon of European populism? Or does the Spanish take on the right inherit something slightly sinister from the past?
So, with drooping, are you looking for a sort of virility rising metaphor for this morning's conversation?
I think so, don't you? Yeah. Having talked about health products to restore manhood in the last section.
Mr. Abascal was seen on a horse during the Andalusian campaign.
No, and he carries a gun or something odd. I mean, how can he carry a gun?
He does. No, well, he was that does need putting into context, because it comes from a serious place. Abascal is a politician from the Basque Country. So he was threatened several times when there was terrorism there. So that comes from that background. It's got a serious background to it.
But if I was carrying a gun, I would be arrested. The other day, the police opened my rucksack and found a perfectly innocent knife, which they took away from me. How is this guy allowed to carry a gun?
I haven't asked him, but there are laws in Spain which allow some people in some circumstances to be allowed to carry guns for personal protection. It's not like the UK, and it's not like America, of course, in the other sense.
Right, so it's not an inalienable right, it's an exceptional permit.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's go back to my question. The new Spanish right.
Yes, sorry.
Is it a is it a European phenomenon?
Horses and pistols. The Spanish right. It fits within that kind of, and it mixes with the background that you mentioned of the sort of traditional further right. I don't know. Sort of still. I'm still very reluctant to use far right or ultra right or extreme right, but we could say further right perhaps. The right of the right in Spain.
Yes, but they would actually deny that they're from the far right, wouldn't they? Abascal says he's just a man of the moment, and he's voicing fears that...
Because if we say far right or ultra right or extreme right, we end up with sort of English League skinheads and bother boots and things.
Absolutely.
That kind of thing. It's not that either. It's not...
No.
So if we look at the history of fascism and Nazism and the real extreme right in the 20th century, say, it's not that. It's not. There's no violence there, too. There's no sort of will to be to do violence on other people. That kind of thing. So where to go with this now? So that's probably why they're reticent as well to describe to accept that label of far right. Although the left now describes them as far right or fascist, but then the left, many people on the left, many positions on the left, and say regional nationalists in Spain describe pretty much anything that's not their accepted view of politics or favoured view of politics as fascist or far right.
Yes.
Sometimes anyway.
Yes, so, those labels are bandied about, aren't they?
We have the historical use of the labels and the contextual use of the labels, but also the way those labels are accepted by different groups over time. It's very complex. But it is a mix of all of those things, perhaps. And those historical trends in Spain or historical identity groups in Spain are still there as well, of course.
And because it's within living memory that we had a fascist state here, it's quite natural for those connotations to be assumed, I imagine, and
right,
for those alarm bells to be ringing.
So I think this is where we have to look at the identity features of those movements or those ideologies and what they were in reality and what they actually want to do nowadays. So let's see, for an example. So, for example, there's still lots of traditional Catholic, very Catholic people in Spain. Okay, so we could say that perhaps in the past, some of those very traditional, very Catholic people in Spain were in fact represented within, okay, this is all very dodgy territory now, I'm trying to have a simple example.
Matthew, can I just let you off the hook here?
Yeah,
with something tangential. Vox, their support, you're talking about Catholicism and traditions here and presumably upholding certain values, but how much of Vox support comes from young people?
Don't know off the top of my head, to be honest.
Okay. So we're not sure whether they are a reaction among old timers or their support is from...
I would say more among older people.
You would?
Generally, and perhaps sort of over 30, certainly. Young people in Spain tend to vote left and tend to vote sort of Podemos.
And that brings me on to Podemos, because of all the droops that are happening, Podemos is the saddest, isn't it? I mean, 3 years ago, Pablo Iglesias was the new darling of Spanish politics. He was the breath of fresh air that we all needed to rock the status quo. And now with his poll ratings, I mean, if they're not exactly in free fall, then they're in steep decline. He must be asking what happened. I mean, we're asking what happened. Aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you asking what happened, or can you tell us what's happening?
I'm asking what happened. So,
poll ratings, what do they actually mean? I mean, who really knows?
Well, the trends are interesting, Penny. So individual polls bounce up and down quite a lot, and it's difficult to read the tea leaves of individual polls. But over time, with lots of polls from lots of different companies, the results do mostly suggest the trends that are then reflected in the elections.
Mm.
So they very rarely nowadays seem to get it exactly right. But for example, in Andalusia in December, nobody was predicting 12 seats. But over the average of the polls before the election day, there was a trend upwards for Vox that was showing, in some cases, sort of 5 or 6 or 7 seats. So it was in the right direction.
It gives an indication more than anything.
I take the average like that as an indication. So for the case of Podemos, which is what Kit was just asking, last year, for the whole year, Podemos was in fourth out of four main parties. All year, sort of 16, 17, 18, 19%. And now we're about to see a couple of polls, if the trends continue like this, where Podemos is pushed into fifth place behind Vox.
Okay, grim times for Podemos. Remind us, when are we actually due an election? We've got municipal elections in May, haven't we?
We've got local elections, European elections and regional elections in many regions. Not all of them, not in Andalusia, for example, not in Catalonia, but in most of the other regions. There are regional elections as well, all on one Super Sunday in May. Next general election is still in doubt. It depends on the Prime Minister. Mm. It's scheduled, if he doesn't call an early one, the next formal one, the next obligatory one has to happen in 2020, summer of 2020.
Now, summer of 2020, summer of next year, that's the deadline. But there's a recourse that he might call a general election prior to then.
Summer. So in 18 months' time, unless he called one before.
Okay. Matthew, we just got time to refer to Gibraltar. The EU is apparently passing this matter on to the UN, you told us yesterday, on the Spain report. And that is like chucking a hot potato, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, this is it's a pretty big victory for Spain, perhaps diplomatically, because the EU has issued a Brexit document, and in the Brexit document there's a footnote, and the footnote says that Gibraltar is a British colony. That word that Britain and Gibraltar don't like very much at all.
So the word colony.
Downing Street has already put out a quick statement yesterday saying that they didn't believe, of course, that Gibraltar is not a colony. So,
right. Is the word colony, that's the stigma that gives Spain a victory here. That gives Spain an edge.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, Spain thinks it does.
Right, because no one likes colonies these days.
But they're not going to. Nobody's going to. Well, I don't know if they're going to change anything in reality. Well, will Brexit affect the sovereignty of Gibraltar? No.
Okay, Matthew, I have to ask you. It's been a while since we've spoken to you. The Spain report is now back. Is that right?
The website is. I've started to bring the website back.
Fantastic. So,
the Patreon platform is great for some things, and it's wonderful for readers to be able to support. And things, but as a publishing platform for different types of content and for organizing that content for readers, all of Vox stuff, all of Catalonia stuff in one place and that kind of thing, not great. So I've just started to bring back a new version of the Spain Report.
The Spain Report. And how do we find it?
thespainreport.es.
Tremendous. Matthew, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to hear your consummate and impartial review. I'm sorry we've had to cut it so short today. And we'll speak to you before very long.
And get well.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Get over that flu.
Lots of vitamin C. Get some of those oranges, down you.
Coming up in the next hour, Stefan Lipka's askance look at Blighty, arbalistas, palms, trees and gardens, visits his amazing garden, and Andy Wood's letter from New Jersey. See you right after the news. That's Israel Nash and a song called Sweet Springs. A welcome back home with Penny and Kit. Talking of home, the concept is an interesting one, isn't it, for us expats? Resident here for 20 years plus and recently returned from a visit to his origins in the UK is our next guest, Stefan Lipka. Steph, good morning to you.
Good morning, Kit.
Very nice.
Good morning, Pen.
Very nice to have you on the programme. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And I wanted to ask you, man, you've just come back from the UK. Were you going home, or is home here?
Home is a curious concept, Kit. I mean, the cliche of home is where the heart is well known, and I have to say that my heart is here on the land in Spain. However, having said that, you know, when I go back, of course, I was in Britain for many, many years, and there's many familiar feelings and emotions that come up from being there. Family and friends, of course, are very important. So it's a very interesting question.
I mean, going back to your roots, you find yourself somewhere unique, don't you? I mean, you have the knowledge of an insider, but you've also got the perspective of an outsider.
That's
a great place to observe from, isn't it?
I think so, Kit. It's really interesting to be back there and notice the changes over the years. And yet, of course, London, I grew up in London.
Did you? Yes.
And London, when I was there, was a world town, but now it's a sort of world metropolis with people of all sizes, shapes, colours, races. You see costumes from Nigeria. You see, you know, people from Arabia. So it's wonderful. I mean, I find it very, very refreshing to go back there.
Would you describe London as an English city?
Not anymore, no. No, you hear all sorts of languages everywhere you go.
A lot of Spanish in London, I remember thinking.
Yeah, it was really interesting, Penny, because I was on the tube one day and I heard some Andalus speaking.
Brilliant.
And, you know, that kind of triggered feelings of home in me. You know, I almost wanted to start speaking to them. But as you know, you don't do that to people in cities. Otherwise, they think you're a complete weirdo.
I can remember most of the staff of Holland and Barrett's on Cameron High Street were Spanish when I went there once.
Yeah, it's weird buying up the shop.
And do you find, though, I mean, I think that yes, I absolutely concur with you that London is no longer an English city, in the same way that I feel Barcelona is no longer, definitely not a Catalan city. Whereas I think Madrid does still feel like a Spanish city or a Castellano city, that great metropolises outgrow the country from which they're a part. And thus there's a sort of disconnect. I mean, but you did an interesting thing, didn't you? You spent time in London just now, and then you went to the provincial, would I call it a backwater of Eastbourne? I mean, it used to always be thought of as a place where one went to sort of basically gently relax in a hospice before the end.
Yeah, my mum moved to Eastbourne about 20 years ago or so. That's why I was there. So I've been to Eastbourne over 20 years. And I don't really think it's fair to call it the backwater because, yes, there are a lot of elderly people there. But there's also a lot of young people because they have language schools there where people come to learn English. Mm. So, you know, that makes a whole different feel. So it's kind of a interesting place to be. And of course, there's always the sea and the downs, which are magnificent.
Going back to England generally, do you find that it accentuates things that you miss here?
Yes, I would say the number one thing that I miss here is culture. I went to the theatre and I looked around at the people there attending a couple of Pinter plays. And I just felt these are my kind of people, and there's very few people here who who I connect with on that level. You know, I was involved in drama for many, many years. And this gives a, you know, a totally different perspective to my enjoyment of culture when I go back. Yes, also, I went to the British Museum.
You're just going back to going to see a play. I mean, going to see a play in your own language is something really special about that, isn't there? I mean, I had to admit, I sat through a play in Spanish recently. It wasn't a long play, but I really didn't understand a lot of it. It was in 16th century Spanish, and
not surprised.
No, it was like a Don Quixote kind of thing in Almagro in Castilla-La Mancha. But when you are bathed in the balm of your own language, that is lovely, isn't it? Really, that full comprehension, a little bit like overhearing a conversation on the tube or on the bus or something. There's that feeling of connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In some ways, I actually enjoy not understanding everything that's being said, because most people's conversations, as you know, are quite mundane. So I don't. I kind of enjoy the not understanding all the Andalou that I hear when I take a train here, or a bus, or something like that.
Pen, you're always talking about understanding conversation, aren't you? And that feeling of connection. That life is a lot easier when you go back.
And as soon as you sort of arrive, I just feel immediately more connected. And I suppose in some ways, not more alive, but you click in more. You're just like, it's suddenly everything's an awful lot easier, isn't it, Steph? You can do this, this and this. And you know how everything works. And everything does tend to work. Don't you think, Steph?
In some ways, I found it quite amazing that everything was working there. I mean, as you know, there's been a couple of knife attacks there recently in London, and I, you know, with the amount of people that are there, I'm kind of incredulous that it holds together at all. Really, I mean, millions of people getting on together is quite phenomenal in my mind.
Because particularly if you're not used to it, so many people so close together and not basically losing their tempers.
We do have to point out you live in a very remote place, Steph, and that the contrast with a city the size of London or any city would be remarkable for you. Tell us though, you said you went to the British Museum. Tell us about the British Museum.
Well, I was intending to go to the Assyrian exhibition, which is on now and has got rave reviews, but I came in the back entrance of the British Museum, which I haven't been in before, and I found myself in the Chinese room from the 7th century, right. And I was completely blown away by the beauty of the sculptures there. So I stayed there for a while, and then I wandered into the next room, which was the Mayan artifacts. And equally, the level of the sculptures, the stunning, stunning craftsmanship was amazing. So I stayed there for a while. And you get the picture. I never made it to the Assyrian exhibition.
Nor did you see a lot about Britain in the British Museum. It's a sort of universal festival of culture, ancient cultures, yeah?
Yeah, and it's free. That's the amazing thing.
Oh, my goodness. Is it really? Wow.
Yep.
That is a gift. Now, as well as access, you were talking about availability, that there are lots of things available, things that we don't necessarily get here, even in plush supermarkets.
I was astonished when I walked into a huge supermarket and there's about 20 different types of butter and, you know, hundreds of different types of bread you can buy, sourdough and all baps and white bread and brown bread and soya bread and all sorts of different things. The availability is quite incredible.
Is it overwhelming, do you think?
Sorry?
Is it overwhelming? Is it too much, or is it like, wow, I can actually, and I'm going to buy this packet of chili and chrysanthemum chips, you know, or lemongrass and turmeric sorbet or something, you know. Are you tempted by it? Are you intrigued by it?
Well, I certainly enjoyed being able to just grab a bar of chocolate, organic chocolate, or kettle chips, which I really love.
Yes.
I mean, nothing like that here.
Oh, no, you do get kettle chips. I think in Ypres, I've seen kettle chips.
Yeah, you just have
chips.
To pay rather a lot of money for them. It's not the same, no, is it?
It's not what, Bob?
It's not the same.
Not the
they
same?
They don't taste the same.
No, I think you find they do.
Well, I think it's like, you know, going on holiday to Greece, and you get this amazing Greek yoghurt and honey. You come home and you buy the Greek yoghurt and the honey, it just didn't taste the same. Do you know what I mean, Steph?
Absolutely, Pen. Yeah. So I fully enjoyed being able to do that. But I'm kind of amazed at, again, that the way that I looked at it was that this all holds together. What happens if the supply chain stops for a couple of days? You know, maybe those millions of people who get on so well might not get on so well when the supermarket shelves are a little bit empty or something like that. So I was very aware that this whole hangs by a thread, really.
Mm. What about nostalgia? I suppose in a place like London, you feel less nostalgic than in some places. If you were visiting a small village, for example. But sometimes when I'm back there, I'm so overcome by nostalgia that landscapes become kind of memoryscapes, and I'm kind of only tenuously connected to the present.
Well, that was interesting because I went, not intentionally, but I took a bus going through the old area of London where I lived, and it's all become restaurants now. So there used to be, ordinary shops for people. You know, there used to be a Woolworths and a Boots and all those, yes. W.H. Smith, all those kind of shops. And now it's wall-to-wall restaurants. So that was really weird. So,
not a lot of space for nostalgia there, then.
No, not at all.
Laments for the past, but not nostalgia. No, I remember going back to Clifton in Bristol, where Penn and I met, actually, in the mid-70s as students. And it's really, really very little has changed, and memories just crawl out of the pavements. They come out of shop doors. And there's the Chinese takeaway, where we used to go in late at night and try and make the Chinese woman smile, you know. That all those places, that pub where we got heinously wasted one night, you know, all those places are still there. There are some changes, but those memories just come crawling out of, you know, bouncing out of our sidewalks and places.
That's interesting because I went, I took a bus through the old area where I used to live, and there were some memories, but really it seemed like a totally different life to me. It was a different person that lived that life. It wasn't me, although of course it was.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a curious feeling.
Mm.
It's almost like an imprint, isn't it? Almost like an imprint, and you also expect to see the same people who were there before, like, or to say, hello, excuse me, I was here first, you know. That's what I was for. Excuse me, hello, yeah, we owned this ourselves, particularly in student
days. That's right,
days.
yes, that's right. What is odd is when you start getting nostalgic walking around your pueblo here in Spain. That's then you begin to realise quite how long you've been here. Steph, lovely to talk to you. Will you stay with us, please, for Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens?
I'd be delighted to.
Because I believe you're going to take us for a little wander around your sumptuously gorgeous finca.
See you in a while.
Okay, we'll just see you right after the break. Bye for now.
Okay.
See you.
Bye for now.
Talk Radio Euro.
At home with the Hogs. With the Hogs. With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
On the land, but it is fed and watered by God's almighty hand. He sends the snow in winter, the warmth to swell the grain, the breezes and the sunshine and soft refreshing rain.
Yes, it is that time of day when we talk about things that grow out of the ground. Welcome to another episode of Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens. And still with us to talk about a fabulous finca returned from the charred cinders of a devastating fire is Stefan Lipka. Stefan, hi.
Hi.
Steph, I wonder if you'd enlarge on this description of your garden. Somebody once said it's like an exotic jewel surrounded by indigenous forest. Tell us.
Oh, that's very kind. Yes.
You have got amazing plants growing there, haven't you?
Yeah, thank you very much. We live in the cork oak forest.
Yes.
Just up from Galfeen. And we've been here about 20 years. And we were here a couple of years when we had a dreadful forest fire, which destroyed much of the plantation, of course. And since that time, we've been busily planting whatever we can. And we have a particular interest in palm trees and exotic plants. So we've tried to planting many, many different types of plants.
Okay. How many varieties of palms have you got?
We had at one time, we had 23 different types.
Really? How amazing. And where'd you get them from?
We got them from a supplier near Valencia who delivered them in a big truck many years ago. And when I say 23 kit, I mean some of them were tiny. Some of them were just little, tiny little plants. And some we'd never heard of before. You know, we just looked at the book and wondered if they would work here. Some have survived, obviously, and some haven't.
Yes. And I mean, the main problem, presumably, is cold for the ones that haven't.
And also the bug.
Okay. Are we talking about Picula Rojo?
We're talking about that.
Red palm weevil.
The red palm weevil, which destroyed a beautiful, huge 40-year-old palm tree that was already here.
Right.
And also has eaten some of the other palms.
Yes. Okay. So not just the Canadiensis. The bugs have eaten. That bug has eaten other of your palms. Are you treating against it?
Well, we were up until recently, but as you know, the remedy, the chemical remedy, is now being outlawed.
Yes.
And we were quite shocked to discover that it actually is harmful to bees. So we're in a very curious position at the moment. We're going to let the palms, let whatever happens to them happen. So on that, on those particular palms, the Phoenix palms, as you know, which are mainly affected by the bug.
Mm.
That's quite a hard decision to make, actually, isn't it?
It's been dreadful, Penny. It's been absolutely dreadful. But we have to do it, because what else can we do? I wanted to ask you, Kit, actually, if there is another way of treating the palms other than the... Is it called neocotinoid or something?
There's a nematode remedy, which I know there's a firm in Bernal Madonna do it. You have to keep them in the fridge, but you can spray with a nematode, which, in fact, do feed...
Well, you can't actually spray nematodes. Nematodes are tiny microscopic worms that burrow into the bicho, into the larva, and eat it from the inside out. They're tiny, and an application involves implanting some ridiculous number, something like 5 million of them into the tree. They have to be implanted at a particular temperature. They have to be kept cold.
Yes.
And you can't spray them, because spraying will actually kill them. So they go in a solution which you apply with a watering can. So nematodes are a possibility, and another possibility is pheromone traps, which are a dish of smelly liquid that attracts the male, and it basically goes into the liquid and never comes out. The liquid is basically, to put it bluntly, smelling of sex, and that's what attracts the male. So you've got those two options, and there are other concoctions of legal chemicals that are being put together by laboratories that you can only actually apply with a license. So I would go with nematodes or pheromone traps.
Yeah. How often does one need to apply either of those?
Can I just say that?
Can I just answer the question?
Yeah, sorry.
Nematodes after 40 days. And if you've got an infestation, oddly, the nematode has enough food eating the bug to survive during the course of the infestation. If you're using it as a deterrent proactively, you have to replace the nematodes every 40 days. Because they've got nothing to eat on.
And there's a website I'm looking at now, because I was just looking it up, called Personal Garden Shopper, personalgardenshopper.es, which can provide you with the nematodes, which we haven't done yet because of, you know, we do so many trees, it could be complicated. And being out on the road and keeping the nematodes cool would be tricky. But I think if you're going to do it yourself personally, then it's definitely worth a go, Steph. I would suggest, if you can.
Steph, can we just go back to your finca and the recovery that it's made since this fire is absolutely phenomenal. You're walking around it now. Are there any scars of the fire that are still there?
I think they've all but disappeared. There's a couple of stumps of olive trees which sprouted from the base, which are pretty charred. But it was quite amazing, Kit, that what did actually recover. After 2 years, some avocados that had been burnt to the ground suddenly sprouted back again.
No, did they?
Yeah, it's incredible, Pen, really.
But with fruiting avocados, with domestic avocados...
These are fruiting avocados, yeah.
Yes, but you can eat the avocados. Then.
Yes, yes. Oh, all right. That's the amazing thing, really. Oranges came back. All sorts of stuff came back.
No, it's interesting about the avocados, because we lost some avocados in a frost, and what's come back has been is been rootstock, not the top stock, but the rootstock below the graft, mm-hmm. and those avocados are like bullets. They're completely inedible. They're not your domestic avocado at all. A bit like an acebuche and a wild olive and an olive. I was wondering though about this. The fire was how long ago?
I can remember the exact date, July the 23rd, 2002. Mm. I will never forget that date.
Yes, one does. In the same way that we remember the flood. What are the... Well, I'm interested, though, the connotations between fire and flood how that interesting a comparison that is, the effects of fire and flood. I mean, in many ways, they're diametric extremes, and yet there are similarities, aren't there?
Of course. The actual destruction of your beautiful plantation is devastating in both cases.
I mean, they both kind of remove everything if they're extreme enough. And so there's a sort of purging or cleansing thing going on, and like a clean sheet. Although obviously with fire, you've got roots that still remain in the ground that can re-sprout.
And also a lovely covering of very beneficial ash over the entire finca.
Okay, and that's phosphate, is it? Ash makes phosphate, is that right, Steph?
I believe so. Kit's the man to ask.
No, he's not. What I can say, though, Steph, is that you've got a soil change there, and we, after our flood, also had a soil change because we got dumped on by huge volumes of what we perceive to be very fertile alluvial silt. So big thumbs up there. And a kind of sanitizing has gone on, a kind of a cleaning out, would you say that, with fire?
Definitely. And it also reminds one of the impermanence of life, Kit, not to get too grandiose about this, but you do realize that things can go in an instant. We take everything for granted so much in our lives, and anything can happen, and particularly when you're connected with the land.
Yes, I totally agree with you there. But it also kind of, I think in our case, it kind of wakes you up in a way, like, well, hey, as you just said, don't take things for granted at all, because it does change. But I also like the concept of renewal. And I would ask you, Steph, what are you planting now this season? Are you planting now for spring?
We're mainly planting vegetables at the moment.
Okay.
We've got a few trees in. We've got some nisperas
and a couple of peaches we're putting in. But basically, I think our trees, limited of trees, has kind of almost reached the maximum at the moment.
Well, you've
mainly more space.
Yeah.
Right, right. Now, I was going to ask you, I know you travel to the East occasionally. Do you ever find yourself bringing back seeds from India and other exotic destinations?
Yeah, we have. We bought some interesting plants. We don't even know what the name of them are.
Sure.
Yellow flowers we bought back from India. We have, wonderful, what's it called? Tamarind, a small tamarind tree.
Oh, yes.
Really? Yeah, we planted that from seed of the tamarind that we brought back.
Well, I could try and get one of those from Epicor and see if that works. Yeah, and it's just that it's a very soft fruit, isn't it? With soft fruit with a hard casing.
Yeah, I don't think we'll actually get any fruit from it, Pen. We planted it about 10 years ago.
Okay.
And I think it's about 3 foot high now.
Right.
But it's quite. We keep it in a pot. We're very lucky because we have a sort of very sunny little corner outside of our house where we plant things that are delicate. Carl's got a papaya on the go at the moment.
Oh, lovely. Right.
Lovely. Yeah, yeah. Great for digestion too, papaya. And you have to recognise the microclimate, don't you, within your own little plot when you're dealing with such sensitive exotics. I remember when we first moved to our place, I was under the illusion that we would live in a tropical paradise, so bought sort of lychees and mangoes and papayas, and they all just froze to death in the first winter. We had frost, and bang, the whole lot went out the window, and I haven't repeated them. That's not to say that we couldn't probably do better if we were to respect the microclimate, the nooks and crannies of a place.
Yeah, it's very, very important to know about your particular piece of land and where you do have those warm spots. One of the things we have to watch out for here is wind. We also lost some beautiful palms from the wind. I don't know if you know the Libistonias?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wind sensitive, yeah?
Yeah.
And they get a sort of wind burn, isn't it? It's sort of horrible.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
exactly.
Steph, what would you say is your biggest pest on the land?
Our biggest pest? That's an interesting question. I think probably voles.
Voles? Oh, really? Really? Yep. What those little, what are they called? Like,
Root munchers.
Yeah. They're like the taponeros or something, aren't they? The little, they're not moles, they live underground. Do you mean those ones?
That's right. We had a whole lot of artichokes, which just one by one disappeared, like the cartoon, you know, I can't remember which cartoon it was.
Yeah.
Suddenly one's dragged under, then the other one's dragged under.
Whoa. And what do you do about those?
The cats.
Oh, a cat, right. But they get in the holes, do they?
No, no, what we do is we just give the cats a little less food and they go for the voles.
Oh, excellent.
Okay, yeah. That's
keep your cats hungry. Keep the cats hungry if you want them to be ratters or vole catchers.
And on that bombshell.
Yes, Steph, we're going to have to leave you now. And thank you very, very much for your time. And it's been lovely visiting your garden and talking about the old country.
Thank you, Steph, so much.
Okay, lots of love.
Have a great weekend.
Have a good day.
And you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.
At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
We're off to the USA now, and it's been a while since we've heard from him, but Andy Wood has set his alarm, especially to soothe us with another inimitable letter from New Jersey. Andy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy New Year to you, Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Oh, yeah, we haven't spoken since the New Year, yeah. How's the New Year going in the States over there?
Well, we had this Arctic blast. So we're all freezing, but
yes.
Otherwise, rather well.
Good. Now, I want to talk to you about the Arctic blast in a moment, but you've just come back from Dubai. And for those of us who haven't been but can only imagine its sheer extremity, what is it like? Give us your impression of Dubai.
Yeah, it's an interesting place for sure. It is a masterpiece of excess. The place is run by people from other countries.
right? It's full of expats. I think there's 5 million people there, 300,000 of which are actual Emiratis. Everybody else just serves their needs. As you may know, they have the tallest building in the world, and so they're building the tallest building in the world. It's not enough to have one. They now want the next one.
But they're building another one.
Yeah,
they've already got one called the Burj Khalifa.
They're building another one to be taller because why not?
Right, okay. So where's all the money coming from? Is it oil?
Well, it's basically oil, and when they put the Emiratis together, the Emirates together, the seven tribes, they really became the commercial hub for that area. So there's a lot of banking and insurance and other things, but basically oil.
Now, I was reading about Dubai. It's a place that I have to admit just holds no appeal for me at all. And having read this, it holds even less. There's a thing called the Dubai Shopping Festival, a sort of group retail,
an appropriate emotional release
in a place with a cultural deficit and a surfeit of frivolity. Have you been to the Dubai Shopping Festival, Anne?
Yeah, it was actually, I think it was either just this month or last month. Basically, shopping is their hobby. So there's massive shopping malls, a lot of very exotic cars parked outside.
And what do you do in a shopping festival?
Shop, obviously.
How is it any different?
They open later.
Oh, okay. Right, okay. No, I was intrigued. All right, so that's enough on Dubai. Let's go to Hell, Michigan, a town which recorded a temperature of minus 25 degrees this week, prompting worldwide wags to observe that hell has frozen over. Yeah, you were going to say it.
Frozen over.
I mean, Chicago colder than Antarctica. I mean, what is that? What is that like?
It's been very interesting. Actually, when I landed in Newark on Friday morning, there were 12 cars on fire in the parking lot at Newark Airport.
Why?
And I think it was something to do with the cold.
It's not funny.
It's not funny, but
12 cars on fire?
Yeah, in the parking lot. It was a big deal. Today, of course, we do everything in Fahrenheit here, so we have to convert for you. But today in New Jersey, it's 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, you know, probably minus 12, something like that.
Right, that's cold.
So, people here cope. I mean, one of the things is that a lot of heating fails because it just runs so hard for so long. You know, heating systems on thermostats. So you get a lot of things breaking down. In my office, we had a burst water pipe and hundreds of gallons of water just flood in.
Right. Not frozen yet. I mean, it's sort of live water. It's still in its liquid state.
So it's just, I mean, but people here are good with extreme weather. So, you don't actually hear of too many people dying on the street.
Okay, in spite of the fact that the mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan, has offered the warning, you're going to freeze or lose a limb if you go outside.
Yeah. That's probably an exaggeration. It's probably just a couple of toes.
I love.
But I mean, the serious problem has been, dealing with homeless people, particularly in Chicago, where they would die. So there's been emergency shelters, and people have been making, extra effort to bring people off the street.
Sure.
Particularly this last week.
Sure, sure. I read here that in Missouri, one police department politely requests that local criminals halt their activities while the cold lasted. He's saying, we're asking for a favor, at least for the next 3 days. Can you keep criminaling at a minimum? That went out from the Warrensburg
Splendid.
Police Department on Facebook. Yeah. That's kind of nice, eh?
Yeah, it's about 60% of the country, which is a massive country, that is suffering. Of course, the southern states aren't really seeing any of this. It's just across the sort of middle and up.
Yes. But what's going on in Canada? It must be really cold there.
Yeah, but they're used to it. And
no one lives there anyway.
I think that the extremity here is that this is just out of the norm.
Yes, yes. Another thing I read was that in Western Wisconsin, there were fears that it would run out of beer. Two distributors said deliveries were being halted for fear that the beer would freeze. The trucks that the beers are delivered in are actually heated, but they're worried that the cans freeze and burst while they're being unloaded.
Further confirmation that it is basically just water.
Yeah, really, yeah. Okay, so you mentioned that the cold weather where you're experiencing at the moment is really coldest in the north and center of the country. Down in Atlanta, Georgia, of course, it's going to be warmer, isn't it? And positively hot for the Mercedes-Benz Stadium for the 2019 Super Bowl, which happens, of course, tomorrow. Now, and you are a Brit living in America. Have you got your head round American football? Are you excited by the prospect of the Super Bowl?
No, not really. Huh. It's you get sucked in because it is a big deal. Like in work, we have a weird pool where you get two numbers and you all put in $5, and it's. So people are engaged in it. Everybody wore sports attire to the office yesterday. So it is everywhere. A million people will descend on Atlanta. A million people.
But they're not even going to get in, are they? What are they doing, a million people?
There's a whole circus this last week, maybe 10 days. There's all sorts of events run by ESPN and by the NFL alumni and all sorts of things going on. And people would like to just be in town. People who can't get a ticket, which is, you know, a million less 70,000. They just like to be in town and watch a game in a sports bar.
Oh, right. Like
soak up the atmosphere.
Yes, yes. Oh, okay, cool.
It's pretty remarkable. The two teams in it, they played before in Super Bowl 36 in 2001, and the Patriots won that. And since then, the Patriots have been to 7 Super Bowls, and the Rams haven't been to any.
So we've got the Patriots against the Rams. Now, the Patriots are from New England, and the Rams are from L.A. And so the Rams are like the underdogs, yeah?
Yeah, it's a bit of an odd thing here. I mean, one of the odd things that you don't get, say, with, you know, football teams in Europe, is that the Rams used to be in L.A., and then they were in St. Louis right up until 2016. Now they're back in L.A.
Can I just interrupt something?
Yes, Bedge.
We're talking about sport. Yes, shut up.
Empathetic.
We're talking about the Super Bowl, which I suppose is the, what's the game? American football, yeah?
So you talk about help me, Hema.
No. So you're talking about a team which was last won in 2001 or something, and now you're talking about 2018. But all the people are different, so it's not the same team, is it?
And nor do they necessarily play in the same place. Apparently, somebody airlifted to St. Louis from LA.
That is what I don't get with sport. It's different people, mostly from different countries, all playing. Yeah, it's very. That's why I think I can't really relate to that.
That's right.
Yeah, they do force them to retire when their joints go.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not the same team. It's just the same name. Anyway, I'd interject there with that.
Interestingly, the quarterback for the Patriots is the oldest player ever to be in a Super Bowl. He's aged 41 this year.
That's knocking on
the
door.
That is knocking
quite remarkable. Yeah. The whole future of football is in some doubt, actually.
How so?
There's some factors beyond their control. There's been a couple of years ago. There's a $1 billion settlement by the league, billion with a B, with the players for concussion. For they knew about the dangers of these concussions. These guys are getting Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, in their late 30s. So now the younger leagues, the leagues that children play in, or schools or colleges, are finding it very difficult to get insurance.
So some of the smaller colleges are stopping the programs, and some of the ones for children at high school or at intermediate school are stopping the programs because they can't get insurance. So you wonder if that might be just a slow death if the hopper isn't full for up-and-coming talent.
Yes, interesting you're saying that, and because there's a similar movement happening in France with regard to rugby. There's been so many concussions that kids are just crying off the game now. They're just not playing it.
It's at a really, really high incidence here, and I think people use rugby as an example. And one of the things is that the problem is the helmet here. Is the helmet, because the helmet basically turns your head into a battering ram, and you can inflict damage with it. So people point to rugby and say there's a lot less concussion in rugby. Maybe we should get rid of the helmet.
Because you're a medical man, really, Andy, aren't you? What's your feeling?
Well, I actually, interestingly, there was a recent paper published by, funny you should ask that by a researcher, and she had been donated. Just to tell you how serious it is, 110 brains of ex-NFL players for research. Whoa. 109 of them had the proteins, significant proteins that indicate Alzheimer's. So it was basically statistically 100% had early Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. So, I mean, it's a very serious issue.
I remember Muhammad Ali, the shock of Muhammad Ali and the reflection that had on boxing. Have any high-profile footballers emerged in the same way that Muhammad Ali did?
Yeah, basically all of them.
Well, and have,
yeah. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but the average career for an NFL player is 2 years.
Really?
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of people who have long careers, Tom Brady being one of them. So
the 41-year-old quarterback that you were talking about.
Yeah, 41-year-old quarterback. He's married to a supermodel. You know, he earns $14 million a year and is really just a genius at the game. He can really read the game well and is a very, very good quarterback, almost insanely good. So the Rams are going to have trouble beating him, but it's just such a big circus, Kit and Pen.
Yes, you're talking. I've got
ads,
here.
The ads are very.
The ads. Tell us about the ads. Yeah.
Yeah, the TV commercials are huge. This year, the network is charging for a 30-second spot. This is before you make the ad. $5.25 million for 30 seconds.
So who advertises? Who's it going to be?
You know, it's Pepsi, it's Visa, it's Budweiser.
Right.
And they come out with these incredible productions, talking horses or, you know, flying babies or whatever. But the ads are what they want people talking about the next day, and 100 million people watch the game.
Yeah.
So yeah. A lot of people just tune in for the halftime show.
Who's doing the halftime show this year?
The halftime show is riddled with controversy this year. You'll be pleased to hear. And usually it's a huge, huge band. But this year, Rihanna turned it down, Jay-Z turned it down, Cardi B turned it down. So they've got Maroon 5, supported by Big Boy and Travis Scott. And 100,000 people have signed a petition asking Maroon 5 to pull out, which they haven't, because of this controversy about taking a knee during the national anthem. So,
Maroon 5 were involved in taking a knee during the national anthem. That's kneeling during the national anthem.
Yes, and that was started by a quarterback, Colin Kaepernick, who took a knee during the national anthem.
He went down
on one knee to protest police brutality, because so many young black men were getting shot by police. So he went down on one knee, and this caused a firestorm. And then lots of other athletes started taking a knee, and then he got fired, and no other team has picked him up. So his career is lost.
And we're going to have to leave you, man.
I was just getting into that. Maroon 5.
Getting into talking about sports, yeah.
It's not more interesting.
Always a pleasure to talk. Thank you so much for joining us. And have a great weekend.
Have a wonderful day, and thank you for sharing. And I hope your listeners have a great weekend.
Thank you, man.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Our thanks to Andy Wood for this month's letter from New Jersey, to Stefan Lipke and Matthew Bennett, and to Rob Humphreys, our director and producer.
Thanks for
who's
being
turned
here.
Up especially to help the studio duffers this morning. It's been absolutely lovely having your company this morning. We wish you a very happy weekend.
Happy weekend. Here she comes.
Say goodbye to the Blackbird. See you next week.
Bye-bye.